The king did not tend to attend these council meetings, which operated like law courts. The councils would review dispatches, they would make recommendations, they generated enormous amounts of paper. But the king did not communicate directly with them normally. Instead, he would be linked to them through a kind of spidery network of secretaries who would prepare agendas for these council meetings, they would take minutes, and redact all of the official documents. Now, there are several drawbacks to this kind of government by committee, although I should add that historians like it because it generates the kind of records I like to look at. But two of the drawbacks of this system of government by committee deserve really special emphasis. First of all, it's a rather cumbersome system. It doesn't make for rapid decision-making. The system generated a never-ending flow of memos and other correspondence. Like I said, the paperwork piled up in Spanish archives is truly enormous. Second of all, government by specialized council tended to impede the development of consistent policies. Since the king's own policies were unknown to councillors, they were often afraid to speak too freely, knowing that he could just reverse or reject anything they had to say. They hesitated to commit themselves to definite positions in case they ended up on the wrong side of the fence when the king finally decided, and therefore fell out of favor. And the king, in fact, would often reverse the decisions of councils without even informing them that he had done so. And these two weaknesses would feed off of each other. The king's reluctance to delegate authority would slow the wheels of government. In fact, Philip II barely had any time to see his family. He was probably the hardest working monarch in all of early modern Europe. His desk was always covered by a mountain of papers. He got up early, he worked all day, he was a true workaholic. And at least in terms of labor intensity, I think we can say these efforts are impressive, maybe even heroic. But nonetheless, Philip did set himself a kind of impossible task. He wanted to keep an eye on everything, he wanted to make all the decisions, and he found it very difficult to discriminate between essential policy matters and routine administrations. The distinction between the important and the trivial often seems to have been lost on him. And to illustrate this, I think we need only cite the example of what Philip was doing in 1588. On the one hand, he was planning the Spanish Armada. He was planning an ambitious amphibious invasion of England, sending ships all the way up to the Netherlands to transport troops over to England. And at the same time, Philip was conducting a vigorous argument with the Pope on the state of the clothing worn by Catholic priests in Spain. And it's hard for the modern mind to see that these were issues of equal or even near equal importance. We might ask, therefore, why on earth so cumbersome a system of government even persisted? And I think we can point to two primary reasons for this cumbersome regime. First of all, there was just an inherent difficulty in governing particularist regions. No part of the Spanish Empire liked to feel that it was subordinate to any other part. We'll see subsequently that one of the greatest grievances of the Netherlands was that the people in the Netherlands felt that they had to pay for other parts of the empire. They didn't like paying for Italy. They didn't like paying for Spain. They only really wanted to pay for themselves. It's a sort of not-in-my-backyard phenomenon, even in the early modern period. Moreover, councils were important because they helped to keep power out of the hands of great magnates and overmighty subjects. The higher aristocracy were not completely excluded from office, and they tended to be favored with appointments to governorships and to viceroyalties. But nevertheless, the councils themselves were bureaucratic committees. They were staffed not by nobles, but by trained jurists. The vague competence and authority of these councils always left essential power in the hands of the crown. The posts on Spanish councils could not be bought. They were never the property of the office holder, and this is a striking difference with the system in France, which we've discussed in earlier lectures. Royal servants and bureaucrats who developed political ambitions could be struck down with impunity by the Spanish crown, and this is again another important contrast with France. Philip II never faced the kinds of factional threats from the Spanish aristocracy that the French crown did from the French nobility. There was, however, having talked about all this particularism and this lack of uniformity, only one institution whose activities applied throughout Spain without any regard for legal frontiers, and that was the Spanish Inquisition, which was authorized in the year 1478 and began operations in 1480. This brings us, therefore, to our discussion of the Spanish crown and the Roman Catholic religion. The Spanish Inquisition was really quite different from its medieval predecessors. The medieval Inquisition, a special court for the detection, trial, and punishment of heresy, had been founded by the papacy in the year 1233 to deal with the heresy of the so-called Albigensians in southern France, and it remained under the control of the papacy in all of its operations. The Spanish Inquisition was really quite different from the medieval Inquisition, both in terms of its origin, what it was created to deal with, and its organizations. In the first place, there really wasn't any heresy problem in 15th century Spain. The Inquisition was instead founded to deal with the so-called problem of backsliding by converted Jews.